Welcome everybody to a new episode of K5 Commerce Cast. My name is Dörte and today I'm talking to Usama. Usama is a CTO of the well-known home and living brand Westwing. Hi Usama, nice to meet you.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Herzlich willkommen zum K5 Commerce Cast. Gemeinsam mit unseren Partnern präsentiert euch das K5-Moderatorenteam tolle Use Cases sowie die neuesten Entwicklungen und Trends aus der Welt des digitalen Handels.
Yes, we already talked this morning, so I'm located in Munich at the moment. You are located in London, at your hometown. I hope the weather is nice in London. I'm not sure. It's really
weather
nice in
never,
Munich.
never nice in London, you know, so, but it's good.
So, actually, I think we should start like introducing yourself a little bit, just two sentences to your person. What are you doing? Where are you coming from? And then I think we have a really, really interesting topic today. We are talking about the legacy transformation at Westwing. So please introduce yourself to the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Usama Dar. I am, as you said, CTO for Westwing. I've been at Westwing now for about a year, but this is not my first time at Westwing. I was a CTO for Westwing 8-9 years ago, back in 2013-14 up to 2016. Then I had to leave, you know, for personal reasons, but then we spoke again and realized that they are about to go on this exciting transformation journey, and I wanted to be a part of that. And obviously knowing the company and a lot of leadership from before, I obviously thought that was a great opportunity. I mean, my background is in technology and product in general. I've worked for both startups and big corporations both at the same time. I've been part of startups in the past in 3-4 different countries, worked for big companies like Yahoo, Huawei, Oracle, and so on, but also at the same time startups that were fairly new and then went on to do great things. So I'm really, really excited to be part of Westwing and really enjoying the journey so far.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. So Westwing isn't a startup anymore, right? You call it a corporate already somehow?
Yeah, this is like I struggle to define it because when we go to talk to suppliers and vendors, they put us in the enterprise category,
yes.
Right? So it's like, well, you're the enterprise customer. But it doesn't feel like a big enterprise, right? It's a public company. Obviously, there are certain mm-hmm. things we have to do, which the startup, for example, has the liberty to not do and move even faster. In some cases, we have to comply to certain regulations and kind of deliberately slow down a little bit. But I think we are still a medium-sized, but still with a very startup mentality company, right? We still want to do things fast. We want to get on top of the new trends and new ideas and not be left behind like, you know, infamously big corporations are known to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this kind of startup DNA, even in a larger environment, helps you to cover and to cope with the project you are currently facing. That's as right. We talked before, you are somehow replacing your legacy. But when it comes to legacy, everybody out here in Germany thinks about old AS/400 solutions, right, or whatever, 30 years right. old. But your legacy is kind of 10 years old and you're already replacing it. So maybe you can That's give right. us a short overview about the project as such, and then we deep dive into later several subjects. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. We do call it legacy because it does seem old. Certainly not as old as you said, maybe big mainframes and AS/400s and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, still very much a modern architecture. However, one of the main things I would say that makes it legacy in some ways that we built everything ourselves. So, you know, more than 10 years ago when Westwing started its journey, there weren't many other options to do e-commerce other than build your own if you wanted to do a serious business, right? I mean, if you are a small business, maybe you could spin up a WordPress commerce site and do whatever you want. But if you are a serious business, you want mobile applications, you want, interesting, you want discovery, you want customer journey, You wanted to do all those things. You needed to build something of your, by yourself. So that's what we did. However, at some point in this time frame, the tide kind of changed, and a lot of stuff in e-commerce became a commodity.
Yes.
And building your own e-commerce system for the next 10 years is not the way to go. It doesn't give us any advantage compared to our competitors. They are able to do just as many things as we can and even more. So we thought, okay, you know, if we need to lay foundations for the next 10 years, we need to take a different approach. And that's what we're trying to do.
So that's a good point you are mentioning. So the project you are now facing is somehow an it's so difficult in English, for your strategy goals you have in the 10 years time frame ahead.
Yeah.
So how does it fit together? What are the major strategic goals you want to realize with the project of replacing your self-built system architecture?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, our goal is pretty clear as a business, right? We want to be a premium home and living brand, right? And again, I'm using those words because in the past, West Wing has described itself in many different ways. We are an e-commerce business. We are a tech company at some point, they used to say. But we are not an e-commerce company. We are not a tech company. We are a premium home and living brand, right? And that's what we want to focus on. We don't want to focus a large part of our organization maintaining tech or solving deep technical issues when they are already solved, right?
Yeah.
And this is what it's about, is to focus our energies, focus our attention on making us a premium brand, right?
Yeah.
And making us and doing things that are important for a premium brand. So installing MySQL upgrades is not something that makes you
not a USP,
not a USP, right? So that's how it fits in. We want to focus our energies on what we want to be, and not do things that don't help us be what we want to be.
So, can you give us some examples? Maybe what is a premium home and living brand when it comes to customer experience, for example, or for a customer journey? What are you aiming for? Just maybe a example of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for somebody who's a retailer, right? And has its own brand line. Of course, you know, a lot of energy we spend is on product development or the products we offer to our customers, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, traditionally, we work with third-party suppliers and we have our own product line, right?
Yes.
So these are kind of two distinct things when you think about products. And of course, working with third-party brands, we want to work with brands which we think fit into this premium home and living category, right? So, you know, filtering out certain brands and only selecting and working with certain brands. And when we are doing our own product development, we want to keep that in mind of what is our target audience, what do they want, and then how can we provide them what they want. So so that's obviously one aspect of being a premium brand. In as far as my responsibility as a CTO for the company, the customer's interaction points with us is our website, is our mobile app, is in-store experience when they go into our West Wing stores and interact with our products or want to buy there. Those are the touch points that the customer has with the technology part of the business. And that's where we want to make sure that the user, I mean, when West Wing started, their website and the design and the experience was unique. It was not something that everybody else offered. And since then, of course, people have evolved and a better user experience has been around even for legacy brands. So we want to continue to innovate in that direction. We want people, when they come to our website, feel like premium, which means high quality, crisp images. We want them to have, you know, video-based interactions. You know, we want to have features like Shop the Look or maybe shopping through our social media channels, which then connect back to our... So basically having a very, very... a unique look and feel to our website, a user experience on our apps, having customer journeys that are linked to the intention that you are using to come to our website. So, you know, we get all kinds of people that come and we can segment them in different ways, but they all want different things. Some are looking for, you know, high-end brands at a discount. Others are actually looking to make a statement with the things they buy. So they both come to the to West Wing with different intentions.
Or just for inspiration, maybe.
Exactly. Some come for inspiration. And we want all of them to have a unique experience when they come to the website. You know, that requires really understanding where they are coming from, what is it that they are interested in, what is it that will keep them on the website or help them achieve what they want to do. So focusing on those things, we feel is more premium than other things that we do.
I think that's a really, really good starting point for your project you are doing. So having your strategy and your future appearance in mind, you now maybe know exactly what to replace, how to replace, where to invest for an individual solution, where to go out of a shelf solution for any software. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can just scope a little bit what you are now focusing on, what you are replacing, what your approach is when it comes to standard solutions versus individual solution, and what are you exactly doing and what kind of time frame you are ahead and so on. Maybe you're more a bit more precise on what you're doing.
What are we doing exactly in this project? So fundamentally, we kind of took a first principles approach, right? So we said, okay, if we had to build this infrastructure all over again, let's say West Wing infrastructure and the technology stack didn't exist and we had to do it for the first time.
Like greenfield,
right? Completely greenfield. Mm-hmm. Because that helps give you clarity. Otherwise, you're always thinking about, can I fit it into the way I do things today? Mm-hmm. And is it compatible with what I have? And we said, no. We just want to think about, first, if we had to do this today in 2024, what would we do? So we started with that mindset. And then what is important for us to control, as you talked about USP? So what is our USP, and what are the things we can just buy off the shelf? Now, as I explained earlier, so user experience and their experience on our website and on our apps and even in the physical stores where they interact with different aspects of the store, that is where we wanted to control something and innovate ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. The website design, the actual user experience, you know, even the font, the kind of images we produce and all of that, we wanted to really customize it to our taste and the taste for our customers. So, of course, that's the bit we have kept on our hands. And so we have gone for a headless e-commerce platform, which allows us to build the user experience completely ourselves. It's completely API driven, so we can actually build, you know, a web based, an app based, or any other interface that we want. Mm-hmm. You know, these days it's very common to have shopping experiences on the channels that you're engaging your customers, even if it's on social media. You know, whichever social media you're engaging in, you can actually provide a commerce experience there. So all of that we wanted to control, and that's possible through a sort of like a headless platform that we've chosen. Mm-hmm. Other than that, we have pretty much decided that most things we don't need to do ourselves, right? From basic e-commerce, let's say, operations, which is about, you know, essentially taking orders from customers and then fulfilling them, right? Mm-hmm. All of that value chain, something that we can actually take off the shelf. So we have taken an e-commerce platform. We have actually chosen for an off-the-shelf search and discovery platform. Uh-huh. Which can do things beyond what we could do ourselves, right? It can offer vector searches, image searches, and all different kinds of intent forecasting for a customer and what they're looking for. We've gone for an off-the-shelf product information management or a PIM system, which really streamlines the way we used to manage products and never really could figure out what's the best way to do it ourselves. So doing that really helps. Content management system, fulfillment systems, order management systems. So everything else we feel is something that does not offer a USP to our customers. It's just how an e-commerce business runs, right? That's just the day in and day out of e-commerce business. So all of that we have decided to partner up with the SaaS providers and so on. Mm-hmm. And the user experience bit, we've decided to keep in our hands. Mm-hmm. And you talked about timeline. So we started this project roughly towards the end of last year. So towards the end of last quarter of 2023, when we actually kicked it off. And we intend to finish this by the first quarter of 2025. So very ambitious timelines. That means about 9 different countries that currently run on the old platform. They will all, or regions, I would say, and they will all be moved on to this new platform.
Yeah. So, and back in last quarter 23, when you started, you already have your had your strategy in mind. So we want to be this premium brand and blah, blah, blah. So how did you start to select certain providers? Did you kind of research and said, okay, this PIM system is bringing everything we need off the shelf? Or is that a standard RFQ you made, or how did you decide for the solutions you are now implementing?
That's a great question, because that was, of course, the starting point. So first of all, we kind of decided that the best thing for us to do is go with the more of a best of breed type approach versus a best of suite type approach. One of the reasons for that is it's interesting, because you mentioned, you know, are you an enterprise? There are some best of suite options available on the market, but they are very, very expensive, right? So you can go with the Oracles of the world, you can go with SAPs of the world, you can go with Microsofts of the world, but they require significant investment, and they are very closed ecosystems in terms of the skill set you need to operate, right? You really need Microsoft Navision developers, experts, or you need Oracle experts or SAP experts, which traditionally are, you know, quite expensive resources, and very, you know, most of them are hard to hire. They work for consulting firms that specialize in these platforms. So they were out of question for us. They would have been far too expensive and far too big of a investment. And funnily enough, I did a similar transformation with Microsoft, you know, using Microsoft Suite prior to coming here. So I kind of had a first experience of what does it take to deal with sort of big vendors like that, and how much time, effort, and money it takes to really do it. So, and in the space we operate in, there wasn't a suitable best of suite that was affordable and that was, frankly, agile enough for us to take. So our natural route for us was to go with the best of breed approach. Now, when we decided best of breed, then our preference was to go with someone who had a large ecosystem around it, right? Because you can pick one and then do all integrations yourself and then do each thing in a different way. But we wanted something where there are enough examples of reference architectures that we can learn from, right? Because there are other people who may not have done it the same way, or may not have transformed the business the same way, but they are running large enterprise e-commerce shops or e-commerce platforms. So which ones, for example, we can find the most examples of, and which ones we can learn from, and which provides us a big ecosystem to choose from, so that you're not stuck with, okay, I picked my e-commerce platform, but what about search? Now you're doing another large kind of evaluation on search, and now you're doing another large version of PIM. So that was one criteria we kind of put together. What we did was we then basically shortlisted 4 different providers. One was Shopify, you know, if you want me to name them. There was Scale, Commerce Tools, and another one.
So there were a few. The well-known.
Exactly. The well-known off the market. You can go to Gartner's list. You can go to the Gartner's list and pick their name. So basically, we went to Gartner. We said, okay, who are these guys? Let's talk to them, right? And we filtered out the ones that didn't meet this initial criteria. And then we kind of filtered out some other ones. And from that on, we did a very quick POC with 1 or 2 of them. Essentially, we took 4, and then from those 4, we basically did a back of the envelope. Okay, what are the pros and cons of these? What do we know about these, right? Can we find somebody who has done an implementation with them? What do they have to say?
Yeah,
so we kind of did some reference calls, very quick ones. And then we honed into one where we did a quick POC to see, you know, would this work? What would be the problems we'd face? Once we selected that, we then engaged a partner who specialized on that platform and was recommended by the vendor themselves. So we sat down with them for 1 month or 1.5 months, and we did nothing but completely visualize what an end-to-end architecture on that platform would look like. And what is their experience from different other clients that they have done similar implementations? What does that look like? So, you know, there are a couple of big e-commerce players in UK and in Germany who are on that platform. So this agency was involved in their implementation also. So we said, okay, let's sit down and draw an end-to-end architecture of what it might look like and what problems we might face based on how we do business, because every business is unique in some ways. So from there, the good thing what came out was not only we were able to visualize it, but we were also able to find a very small list of other partners we would need on top of, because as we said, we went for best of breed. So we needed an e-commerce platform, we needed a search platform, we needed a PIM platform, we needed a CRM, we needed a middleware, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And from their experience and from what other customers were using, we were able to shortlist a list of vendors or a list of partners for each one of them. That kind of worked out of the box with that platform, which meant we didn't have to worry about too much integration. Of course, we had to do some changes based on what information we want to exchange between two systems or whether we want to put some business rules on them. But by and large, we were able to shortlist. So we actually got done with this whole process of, you know, thinking about it, selecting the first sort of main platform, and then finding all the interlinked platforms within 3 months, I would say. So the first 3 months, this is what we did. We created a concept, a high-level architecture that we could take to the team and say, this is what we're going to do. And one thing we were conscious of is that if we waited till we have all the answers, because, of course, you can draw a high-level architecture, a lot of time the devil is in the details. Like, okay, what this bit's here, how does that work? And we said, look, by and large, we can see that this is working. And let's take an agile approach where we take this, break it down into an MVP, and start implementing that rather than waiting to find all the answers, because then we're sitting another 6 months.
You are never done.
Never done, right? So let's break it into a MVP. Let's start to deliver it and start to build it. And we'll learn along the way. And if we learn something dramatic, then we will adjust course. But because we consulted with people who have taken this journey before, I think we were able to anticipate a lot of those things.
Yeah.
Some new things, of course, came up along the way, but
of course
we have enough intellectual, capacity resources within the company and resources to solve them. So,
So, and now you are kind of, you left the concept phase and drawing and talking to these several partners. You are now in the middle of the project, right?
Correct.
Now reality comes in. You have several partners to orchestrate, which might be also sometimes challenging. You know, somebody's talking about A, the other person is on B, and then everybody's going away and doing other things. Not
absolutely.
So how are you stuffing this project at the moment, and how are you orchestrating the agile approach, maybe on 4 weeks sprint planning or whatever you're doing? Maybe you can give us a little bit insights on that, how you are currently doing and how you're organizing it.
Yeah, 100%. So I would say, first of all, the projects like these or programs like these or transformation like these are either successful or failing based on how you run them. Because often the technical aspects are not the parts that fail you, because you know, most of this technology is in production one way or the other in shops and platforms larger than us, right? Somebody is doing, you know, billions in GMV and running these platforms, so they work. So it's often not the technical aspects that would break you. Even if you find some scenarios, you can find ways to get around them and solve them. But of course, the coordination and the changes that would now occur and orchestrating them, like you said, is, I think, often where this can be made or break. So we call this project Dragonfly, and we have a steering group at the top. So essentially, that is made up of the execs and myself and some of the key leadership that is you know, essentially making some key decisions or unblocking stuff when it happens. Underneath it, we have essentially two bodies. One, we have what we call a program group, and one we call a technical design authority. Mm-hmm. So the technical design authority is where we have all the key technical people part of, and this is where we take all the technical decisions. So none mm-hmm. of the technical decisions is made in isolation. This is not allowed. Mm-hmm. So essentially, we maintain, from the beginning, we created a decision log and said all the things we needed to decide, right? You know, which could be how are we going to transfer product attributes from PIM into mm-hmm. you know, into our platform, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how are we going to do? Okay, this is a decision we need to make. So we kind of listed down all the decisions we needed to make. And then we broke that whole program down into what we call work packages. Mm-hmm. And each work package is owned by a team. So we are kind of essentially made up of small teams. Each team owns a certain area of our stack. And those work packages were then divided between those teams. Those teams essentially work on a two-week sprint cycle. Every sprint, mm-hmm. they kind of take a problem. They take a bunch of those items from the work packages. If they are making a technical decision of how to implement this, they would bring it every week to the technical design authority meeting. They will discuss pros and cons of their approach. We would either tell them this looks good, you can go ahead with it, or we'll tell them maybe you should think about this or that.
Yeah.
Everybody mm-hmm. else pitches in there. And based on that, once their approach is final, they, of course, then planning on all the tasks and they are executing them. And then they are. We have a staging environment, we have a test environment there, it goes in, it gets tested, it gets deployed, and so on. Then we have a program body where we actually make product-related decisions. Right? So, for example, when you move platforms and you move the underlying systems, a lot of things will change. And they will not be possible in the way you did before, right? For example, we used to have our own voucher solution. Everything was built in-house. So we kind of, everything was a voucher. Now, on the new platform, everything is not a voucher. There are discount codes, there are gift cards, there is account credit.
Products,
and all of those things need to be now used instead of vouchers, right? Mm. So now how will that work? What would the customer see? What would the communication be with them? These are all sort of product-related decisions which are not technical, essentially, what is the user experience going to be? How would the company work? How is the marketing team working with this functionality? How would they work? How would their experience look like? Mm. All of those decisions we make in the program body. So that's made up of all the, you know, the leads, product managers, myself, and a couple of other relevant people. And then we have a business DRI and a technical DRI for each work package. So the business DRI is somebody who is linking up from the business side saying, okay, I'm responsible for helping them unblock, help them understand this problem. And fundamentally, all of that is then going into Monday board that we use as our main tool. Mm-hmm. And that's where we track it. That's where we review it every week. And so far, we have, you know, when we started this, we thought, okay, by the end of March, we would be 80% done for our MVP.
Yeah.
We are 75% done, but very close. We are tracking very close to to our target. So so far, so good. So that's generally how we manage it. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. A lot of work, but another question which came up in my mind is, you are doing this now with the program and project team on asset before, kind of a green field. You are developing as you've been inventing Westwing the new way.
Yeah.
And you still have your day-to-day operations, of course.
Correct.
Which might be sometimes develop into conflicts or not. You tell me, because you need the people from the day-to-day business, which are into business, giving you advices maybe from the business, how you're doing this and that at the moment, how it will be changed. So how do you manage maybe resource conflicts? You have dedicated people in the project, or how do you manage?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of splitting new world and the old world. Mm-hmm. I feel like there used to be a big debate in the corporate world, as they say, that the organizations need to be ambidextrous. And ambidextrous means you need to be able to write with your right hand and your left hand at the same time, right? Which means in the corporate world, you need to be able to do the new stuff and the old stuff at the same time. Mm-hmm. Now, That was the principle. So I didn't want to ring fence people. Okay, this person is for the old platform. This person is for the new platform. Mm. You can also imagine that this is very bad for your motivation. If you are in the old world platform, you're like, okay, I have no future here. And if you're in the new one, it's like, yeah, I made it. So we didn't want that kind of distinction between people. So first thing I did was I really pushed for a complete code freeze on the old platform. I said, look, whatever you have today, you have to live with it until the new world is ready, right? Perfect. Obviously, that was a very hard sell because that's something the business is like, whoa, it means we can't do anything.
Yes, but I can't reach my revenues, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. So what we do is every quarter when we do our quarterly planning, we do some agreement on, okay, what are the most critical things you want us to do that don't put our Dragonfly timelines into question? Mm-hmm. And if there is a conflict, let's say, you know, Team X actually wants to do a new way of doing Instagram feeds, let's say, mm-hmm. and that requires manpower from the marketing tech team, and it's like, can we actually do this both and reach our quarterly target? If the answer is no, then we say, look, we have a certain budget that we have set aside just for this project. So then we then pay from the project budget to hire maybe additional resources that might be able to do that. So we kind of try to manage it at a quarterly basis. We don't do, or we try very hard to resist, and I think 99% we're successful, of not responding to an ad hoc request unless it's really, really critical where you have to do it. Okay, that's fine. But everything else we have to agree on during our quarterly planning. And in that quarterly planning, we then see if this would work. Do we need extra resources? And so far, business has been very understanding because, you know, it's run with the full alignment with all the execs. So they also understand that this is the most important thing. So when you are operating in that environment, it also becomes a little bit easy because then I'm not the only one defending this sort of this environment, but everybody is trying to accommodate and say, okay, what is absolutely necessary? What can wait? And there are many things where I said, just wait till this new platform comes online and they said, yeah, that's good enough. We can wait for that.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a constant negotiation, right? It's not
of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So every day we wake up and say, hey, can you do this? And it's like, wait, can it wait? Can you afford to, you know, also sometimes you have to ask people to put the money where the mouth is, right? So it's like, if this is really important, are you willing to spend money to do it? And if the answer is no, it's like, do you really want it? And I think,
and imagine it's your own money. Yeah, you have
exactly,
to ask
that. Exactly. Yeah. And often when you say, are you willing to pay for it? And then it's like, maybe we don't really need it.
Yeah, my budget. Yeah, exactly. I see. So when you are now, just let's talk about data migration. So you have, I don't know, it feels like a million SKUs and products for your club business, for your shop business. And somehow you have to migrate them into your new platform.
Correct.
So I think not at the moment, but it's coming soon. Or are you already migrating piece by piece? I don't know, to have something within the new MVP to play with. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Maybe you can tell us something about how you think about data migration when it comes to products, consumer data needs to be migrated maybe somehow, and how to separate this from the old world, some of which maybe kind of a monolithic structure, then transforming it into the new distributed environment.
Data migration is one of the biggest work streams that we have in this, and there are different types of data migrations, and we're handling all of them differently. So first of all, one of our principles was that when a customer comes to the new platform, they should not feel any different in terms of being able to log in or being able to use the platform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of our customers never log in because they are already logged in when to come to the website. So we remember their logins for over a year, and a lot of them just keep coming back, so they never have to log in. And a lot of them wouldn't remember their passwords ask them to log in again. Right? and we also know that if we ask you to log in again, or ask you to change your password because we've changed platforms,
it sucks.
That's a big friction, and a lot of people will just drop off. So we said we don't want to do that. And this has been one of the ways we've done this project, where we have set rules like, this is, we want this and not that. Okay. And now find a way to make it possible. Because it's very easy to say, oh, this platform supports this, so we can't do that. It's like, okay, but our principle in many cases is this. So let's do that in the platform. So when we went to the new platform, if we talk about customers, going back, we have different types of data. We have customer accounts, which is about your username, your password. We have your payment data, so your credit cards, your sort of
purchasing
other payment
history.
Methods, purchasing history, order history. And then, of course, there is products and SKUs and all of that, right? So they're all kind of different categories. The easy bits, the credit cards and the payments and so on, they are handled by our partner whose platform it is, because they are able to take data from our old platform, our old payment providers, the credit card tokens, the PayPal tokens. They're able to take that and bring them into the new platform. So when a customer is buying again, their credit card and PayPal and all of the information they've stored with us will be there, and it'll be stored in a secure manner, not on our platform, right? Mm-hmm. And the second bit about customers, so there we basically are rolling out this this project country by country. So the first country will be online by the end of May, or towards the end of it, 23rd of May. That's the target. It's a new country, so we don't operate in this country today. So the first country is a completely new country. Reason we did that was because there's no GMV loss with a new platform and a new country.
This
it's only GMV gain.
We call it the Versuchskaninchen in German.
Yeah, exactly. So we decided to start with a completely new country where the customers don't have any conception, any preconceived notion of how Westwing is. And we said, let's try that. And if the response is good, then we know we have something that works. Then we can go to a small country next, which already exists. And then from there on. So essentially, our rollout plan is made up of smallest country, from starting from a new country, moving to the smallest country, and then gradually going to the biggest country. So the biggest region, DACH, is by first quarter 2025. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is so we can learn our lessons. And then if there is a mess up, it is affecting a small percentage of our customers rather than everybody. And then we are able to decide how to move forward. So that's the fundamental. And we are actually migrating customers the same way. So we are taking the customer. So the first country, there's no customer migration because no customers exist.
Only new customers.
Only new customers. Mm-hmm. For second country, we are taking the customers from our existing country, their accounts, and then we are basically migrating them over. And the way we've done it is a little bit smart, I would say, is when the customer comes to a website, because we don't know their password, you know, they would log in, and that's the point where we would actually migrate them, because now we know who you are, what your password is, and now we can migrate you to the new account. So we're keeping both accounts live, and as soon as all the customers for one country are gone, we will switch that off, and then we go to the next one, and so on.
I see.
And then the order history and so on is done the same way. We have in the beginning had to do a mapping of, okay, this data in the current platform is called X, and in the new platform the data structure is kind of fixed, right? You can't create. So we did a mapping of, okay, what would be transformed to it, and what we realized was that, you know, in the old platform everything was in one place, like you said, it was a monolith, and in the new world we have to take some of that data and put it into the e-commerce platform, like customer accounts. Other data like products and SKUs we had to put in the PIM. Right. So, and then from the PIM system, they go back into the e-commerce platform. Mm-hmm. So we had to map that. But then I think that exercise took roughly a few weeks, I would say a month, where we actually sat down and mapped all the items. But we were able to translate our data set into multiple systems, e-commerce, ERP, and PIM, and so on. And that process is going to start, as I would say, a month before we go to an existing country.
So the mapping was a manual work, or did you use any help from any systems? Like, I spoke to other companies doing that also with the help of AI, because when they have these really, really old legacy and they have like data fields like a endless string, and then they use kind of AI to separating it. Or was that a manual work with you, because you were more mature in organizing your data?
Yeah, I think that ours was not as bad. So, I mean, I said, the system is, you know, 10 years old. So it's not, it's still relational database. Yeah. The fields are pretty clear. So there was very few data points where we wondered, why do we need this? And there were some examples where we said, ah, this doesn't sound necessary. You know, for example, for a price, we had 10 different fields. And I was like, we probably don't need 10. We probably need 3, right? Okay. So we kind of rationalized it. We removed certain parts of the data and brought them in. But that was all done in a fairly manual way. We didn't have to rely on any AI or anything.
Oh, yeah, that's good. So was it the same with the product data? So with the, I can imagine that in future you might serve other categories for consumers to make it more sophisticated or more unique. It's not like chairs, tables, forks, and knives, maybe other categories. So, and as you said, the first country will be live end of May. I imagine your product catalog is kind of fully migrated already, or isn't it?
Yeah, it's roughly all migrated or very close to it. So essentially, The SKU is an interesting topic because we had some additional problems or additional challenges with the SKU, and the challenge is that we always duplicated the same product into multiple SKUs. Imagine a club model where you're running campaigns, right? And you make a deal with a supplier, you create their products, you put them in a campaign for 4 days or 7 days or whatever long the campaign lasts. And then the campaign ends, right?
Yeah.
Now you're no longer selling those products. Now, next time you put something else. Now, maybe 3 months down the road, you said, oh, that campaign was really successful. Let me run it again. And the way we did it was we duplicated those SKUs, gave them new SKU numbers, and then ran them again. For the same item.
Oh, yes, my goodness.
And sometimes this was because we got the same item now from a different supplier, so just kind of change it. But but because it became kind of like a rule, they always duplicated the SKU, right? And because of that, we accumulated over 20 million or 30 million or some really large number of SKUs. So one of the biggest pain points during this was to clean that up luckily we at some point decided to have something called a master SKU, which kind of linked them all together. So we were able to take that and then map them into a single SKU. But the biggest challenge for us is that because we are going to have the old world and the new world running in parallel until all the countries are migrated, some systems are going to be running on duplicate SKUs, and this new system is going to be running on unique SKU model, right? So how do you map that? So we had to build some intermediate middleware, you know, which basically translates the SKU numbers between two systems. So we have those kind of challenges because of the way we kind of manage our SKUs. But mapping the SKUs themselves into categories, and let's say this is what also determines your navigation, how the website navigation works and so on. That was relatively straightforward. I think we did simplify it. For example, we used to have endless levels of navigation, so you could have categories within categories within categories within categories. So we limited it to like 3 or 4 levels, and we cleaned it up a little bit. But the category structure within the platforms we picked is very flexible. So you can change them, you can rearrange them, you can reassign them, and it all then translates rather automatically in the way your navigation works and so on. So that's one of the advantages of going to a SaaS provider, is that all of that is thought about and is fairly flexible and configurable rather than hard-coded into your code base, right? That's how we.
So maybe in future categories are less important when it comes to customer experience. Maybe a real good search is more important.
Absolutely.
What I think. Yeah.
I definitely agree with you. Is that very few people, click go to the menu, go to this category, go to this category.
Like
so having an amazing search and discovery features for your platform, I think, is critical. And we have seen that when we did not have a great search and great discovery, and when we had it, the difference in conversion and people actually finding products, it was huge. So I definitely believe that that's the way to go. That's why before this project started, we were maintaining our own search and our own discovery platforms. We kind of built it ourselves. And it was great for the purpose, right? You know, the team is great. They are very, very smart guys, and they built something great. But you have off-the-shelf search providers which specialize in it, and they have a roadmap that if we had to do it, we'd have to hire 100 more people, right? Yeah. You know, we talk about AI-driven search. You talk about a vector search. You talk about image search. All of those things, if we have to do and continue to innovate, we would need, 1,000 people. So part of this project was to bring in a platform which provides us a really, world-class search and discovery capabilities, which translate into everything, not just free text search, but also, the way you are ranking your products when you open a category, right? Mm-hmm. So you open the chairs, in which order should they show, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have a really smart ranking algorithms that actually, highlights the ones that, not only has a highest chance of conversion, but in many cases, depending on the customer, what they are more interested in, then it changes the way the customer experience feels like on the website, right?
Yeah.
Imagine not having to go through thousands and thousands of products and getting to what you wanted right away. I think having a great search and discovery product there helps. And again, this is what we're doing.
That's what I call the white shirt problem. So it's insane. Exactly. And I think in future, you are doing a really good job on just presenting not 100%, maybe a 95% options to consumers, which they like. Yeah.
Correct.
We have all the technology out there. You need smart 100%. Integration, I think. And even, when searching on Google, you can write stupid stuff. Even Google know what you're searching for.
They know your intent. They know your intent. So I think it's all about knowing your intent and what you are actually, why are you coming here? And I think if you know your intent, then you can give them what you want.
So I think really smart. You are focusing on the right things. But let me just for the last couple of minutes, there's always a reality when you're now changing all the, my wording is that kind of customer facing products, all this what consumers see in the future. You have to integrate into your internal, I call them back-end systems like ERP and blah, blah, blah. So so I think one step is just separating this now out of your existing legacy and then connecting it again to your, Navision or whatever you have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, this is also customer experience then that this works all perfectly together. So how is your architecture approach? Is that why are a middleware kind of what are
yes,
you doing
yes,
there?
Yeah, we believe in sort of loosely coupled, eventually consistent systems, right? Which means that they don't need very tight integration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, an example of a tight integration is that you update something here and it's right away updated somewhere here, right?
Yeah,
we avoid those kind of needs because if you have to do that, then the mishmash of all the things that need to be integrated into it that becomes too complex and too hard to maintain, right?
Yeah.
Because imagine trying to monitor all these connections if they go down and then it'd be hundreds of them or thousands of them. So we obviously subscribe to a more loosely coupled approach where data is exchanged through messages between systems. So on the e-commerce platform, for example, every time somebody would buy something or somebody buys something, it triggers something called a webhook, which essentially sends the payload of what was ordered to a middleware, and then the middleware disseminates it to whatever systems are interested in that information, right? So maybe that order information, like you said, needs to go into the ERP. Maybe that needs to go now for sure, needs to go to the fulfillment system because somebody needs to fulfill it. The customer care system needs to see it, and the search system needs to index it, and everybody needs to do something with that information.
Yeah.
So essentially, an event bus / middleware approach where the messages go in and they get disseminated. And the same goes for the other way around. So if, let's say, the fulfillment system needs to say, oh, sorry, this item is out of stock now and you cannot fulfill it, that information now needs to travel back to the e-commerce system and goes back to the user and so on and so forth. So that's the approach,
But from a, I'm not a total expert in that, but from an architecture perspective, you need to somehow put some really business-specific logic into it, right? Because you have peak times when people, I don't know, they order in the evening, they're sitting on the sofa, and then they are browsing West Wing and ordering, and you have these high load on Christmas. But on the other hand, you have then high load on product information when it comes to certain campaigns or whatever.
Yes.
So there must be a kind of a business trigger logic not to develop high load on all these connections, right?
Yeah.
So that might be your specific knowledge you have then for your company.
Yeah. So because all of these systems, I mean, our legacy system is traditionally scaled for traffic because it's been doing that for the last 10 years. And when we have the peak period, especially let's say collection days or big sales or Black Friday, we have an SOP. We kind of know how much traffic, or we can anticipate how much traffic we're going to have. And then we always sort of keep a lot of room there for extra. And there is a group of people who know exactly what to do, how to scale it, how much to scale it for.
I see.
For the new systems, as far as the scaling of is concerned, because they are all cloud-based, you know, SaaS systems, they are, most of them, I would say, almost all of them are auto-scaled. So essentially, as the traffic goes up and down, they go up and down in terms of scaling because, you know, they are either based on AWS or Google Cloud or something, which basically, you know, is Kubernetes, for example, managed, and you can have auto scaling in them. So from a scaling perspective, most of it is taken care of. And actually, the e-commerce platform we use did volumes of something crazy. Of one store did 22,000 orders per second on that platform, right? So we are nowhere close to those kind of numbers, and therefore, you know, perfectly scaled for traffic. But there are certain business rules that apply on integration. For example, let's say once an order is being picked, you can no longer cancel it. Or, you know, let's say before 24 hours, you cannot cancel it. So so there, essentially, we do have to write or configure business logic either through, let's say, functions or Lambda functions or Shopper, you know, whatever whatever way we use where we have to introduce business rules, we have to write them. So so that is true. So it's not, how to say, a dumb integration where this data goes from here to here. You know, of course, the data goes through certain business rules. You know, is it allowed to change this, not allowed to change this? And this is where, of course, our business specific needs come from, right? Mm-hmm. So that work is unavoidable. We
of have course, to do it. Yeah. So, and let's imagine you are done in early 25. Everything is up and running. Hypercare is done. Biggest markets are on the new platform. So, what is your personal opinion about 25 and beyond?
Yeah.
Where maybe not on a larger scale, not only for West Wing. So maybe from your experience you have, well, so where do you think e-commerce is then evolving into in 2030 or whatever?
So I think that this, what we're doing, is merely putting the foundation for us to be able to do other things, right? This is not the end goal. This is basically enabling us to get to the end goal, right? Because, so what do we want to do as a business? So this is where we have to start, right? And like I said, you know, one of the, you know, the I would say the main message, again, premium e-commerce brand, and we want to roll out new countries and new stores. That's one of our key growth strategies, right? So we essentially, you know, hoping that with this platform and the ease of starting new markets, because, you know, in the old platform, let's say you want to go to a new country, okay, you have to, you know, configure that from one end to the other to say, oh, okay, new country, how long is the project, right? We are hoping with this, we can start new markets, you know, within days, within weeks. And this allows us to scale to what extent our imagination is. So essentially, our CEO and the board has said, look, we want to go into new territories and new countries fast. And part of that is you want to be able to go there fast and you want to be able to get out of there fast if it doesn't work out, right?
Okay, perfect.
And if your investment in doing that is as low as possible, then it enables you to do that. Because if you commit millions of euros into going into a new market and it doesn't work out, oof, you know, that's not good.
Yeah, I see.
So this platform allows us to move into new markets.
It's open like a
new
pop-up strategy, like pop up into whatever, and
new
then
region. You know, maybe we can start five new regions. You know, next year, and five new stores next year because the technical overhead of doing that is low, right?
Yeah.
And then that's the main strategy is growth. Now, one of the key things, as you would know, for growth is that it needs to be scalable growth. Like it needs to be, it should not mean that every time we go to five new countries, we need to 5X our team, right? Yeah. We need to be able to do that efficiently. So one way is this platform. And then there are countless other things we want to do. We want to leverage AI in many, many different ways.
You
know,
course.
We already are doing that in, you know, a lot of image production. We want to continue to do that. We want to, have more and more and creative work done through AI, whether it's video production or image production or copywriting.
Yes.
We want to be able to go into markets without worrying about fraud. So fraud detection minimizing it is another big application of AI or machine learning that we want to use, because one of the things we do is, for example, if you're a repeat customer and you come to our website, you don't have to remember any of your payment details. It's already stored. You just click a button and you're done. What it also does is that if your account gets compromised, somebody can just buy from you without knowing your credit card. So having a very strong fraud detection system and capability, especially when you're going to new markets, is very, very important.
Key,
so that's another area we want to be very, very cognizant of. And like I said, we were talking about knowing customer intent, knowing who your customer are, knowing what they want to do on your website. So all these customer analytics, I think, is another area we want to really be good at, because we want to know why you are on our platform and what is it that we can do that will get you there faster. Yeah. And I think that we have done it so far by sort of predetermining certain journeys and then kind of leading you through them. We haven't gone to true personalization of when you come to our platform. We really know, okay, you are this person and this is what you want.
Yeah.
So that is another big area I think we need to work on. So those are the things that will make us more scalable, would allow us to go and interact with more customers, be in more markets, which is eventually the goal.
And being even then in the end really, really relevant to your consumers.
Absolutely.
Just as you said, imagine maybe I'm a person into Scandic design or whatever, you then learn and know about me and you can offer on target, where everybody's like the decade before, everybody was talking about personalization, but nobody did really good. So we now we are on the edge on doing this by using technology the smart way. So
100%.
My last question is a personal question to you, Usama. So being in this big project, and there are a lot of listeners out there facing these projects and all the complexity and decisions, and they are maybe afraid and they are, and it costs money, obviously. It costs money, big decisions. And so what is your personal device being a tech leader in the industry to those listeners who had to do the same somehow in future?
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest blockers, in my opinion, like you said, is fear, first of all. A lot of people say, we love the idea, but we would never attempt or we would never dare to attempt it, right? Because it sounds risky. So I think some of it is being, bold, which we know, of course, is not easy to do. But you can be bold without putting your business in unnecessary risk, because at the end of the day, it's the risk aversion that's stopping you from doing that. But if you can find ways that you can be brave without having a terminal danger to your business, I think it makes it slightly easier. So the first thing we had to do was to think about, can we do this without putting our business through unnecessary risk, right? And And having a some sort of a visualization or ability to demonstrate how that would be possible. Mm-hmm. So, for example, this rollout plan of starting from a new country to a very small country mm-hmm. and gradually yeah. going, the ability to do that, of course, that requires us to do extra work because we have yeah. to find ways for both systems to coexist. I mean, it would be easier if we just flip the switch one day to the yes. next and everybody is mm-hmm. on a new platform. But we have to do a lot of extra work, and it's by no means trivial to maintain those two systems. But the reason we do that is to give everybody this peace of mind that at any point, if something goes wrong, this is under control, and the damage yes. that it does mm-hmm. is limited and not actually the whole business.
Even for the CFO is feeling safe.
feeling safer than he would have if we said, look, from tomorrow onwards, this is going to go, right? And part of it is also a little bit of a mindset, right? Yeah. If you look for problems, you find problems, and if you look for solutions, you look solutions, mm-hmm. you find solutions, right? I don't know if you've seen the famous video on YouTube of if you can spot the gorilla, and the video really is that people are dancing in the room and you are supposed to see a gorilla, which most people don't see. There's a gorilla in the room nobody sees because everybody is looking at people dancing. So the gorilla yeah. just passes by and nobody looks at it. And for me, it's very important to keep an eye on the upside and not to worry too much about what if this happens and what if
yeah,
that happens.
Yeah, I see.
There are always people, and those people in the company should exist, right? Because they provide you the other perspective of things. What if things go wrong? And of course, what if things go wrong is bad, and you have to find assurances where if things go wrong, the damage is limited, but you have to keep the eye on the prize. So I think for me, the important thing every day is to think about the upside of it rather yes. than worrying about the negative effects of it. Mm. And I think that that optimism obviously keeps you looking for solutions rather than finding ways of what, because every day we find something, we say, how do we solve this?
Yeah.
Rather than, there's another reason not to do it. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? So so far this has been a good approach because when we started and you ask someone, how do you go through this whole complicated setup, people would find. I don't know if you are familiar with a class of algorithms called greedy algorithms in computer yeah. science, something called greedy algorithms. I'm a big fan of them because that helped me navigate complex problems. The premise of greedy algorithms is very simple.
Yeah.
You have to go from point A to point B in a graph.
Yeah.
And that graph is too complex. There are too many ways to get yeah. from point A to yeah. point B, right? How do you do that? Okay.
Like the simplest approach is,
yeah. The simplest yeah. approach would be, okay, look at all the possible paths and find the smallest one, right? Mm-hmm. But what if finding the smallest path is too expensive? Maybe it takes 10 years to calculate that because it's yeah. too many paths. So the greedy algorithm says, don't worry about the shortest path and pre-calculating it. Just find a way to go from point A to the next immediate point B. When you are B, find a way to go from B to C. And if you do it enough times, you will end up at the end of the graph, and most of the times you'll be close to optimal.
Yeah.
So we take the same approach in tech. We don't worry about solving all the problems. We yeah. can't.
You can't.
We are not superhumans, right? So just yeah. worry about what do you need to solve next. Solve that. Go to the next one.
Yeah.
And eventually you get there. Of course, we time box it. We don't allow ourselves to spend yeah. 6 months on one problem. We say, we need to solve this in 2 weeks. What yeah. can we do, right? And then people are smart enough that they're able to do that. I mean, the yeah. team has been incredible. So
I like that. It reminds me on trail running, what I do is like, when you have a 40Ks ahead of you running over the
one step
mountain,
after the
you will never do it. You need to think, I need to this 500 altitude, then
correct.
next step. Oh, I'm running out of time. Maybe I speed up a bit.
And yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I like the approach. It's really good. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
So good advice to all the CTOs, CIOs out there facing the same challenges in the next couple of months. So, Usama, thank you very much for taking the time and talking about your project. I think it's going to be very inspirational for the audience. And I wish you all of success you need and all persistence you need for this project. And thank you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maybe see you in Berlin then on K5 conference.
Yeah. For sure.
Thank you.
For sure. Thank you.